Hello, and welcome to our program, Archaeology, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Patty Martin, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from Archaeology Magazine here on OWL Radio. The first of the articles I'm reading today is titled The Emperor of Stones. This was written by Daniel Weiss. In the language of the Vikings, Old Norse, rock means monolith, and no other runestone stands out from its peers in more ways than Sweden's rock. The 5-ton stone measures 8 feet tall, and its 5 sides are covered with the longest runic inscription in existence. Some 760 runes divided into 28 lines. And while the vast majority of runestones date to after the mid-10th century AD, the rock was inscribed much earlier, around AD 800. It's the emperor of runestones, says Henrik Williams, a runologist at Uppsala University. Nothing can compare with it. Although scholars are united in recognizing the rock's singularity with regard to its meaning, all they can agree on is that it was set up by a local chieftain named Averin as a memorial to his son, Vemoth. The stone's inscription has defied attempts at interpretation since the mid-19th century, when it was transcribed after the rock was removed from a structure into which it had been built centuries earlier. Decoding the inscription is made especially difficult, as it features several styles of writing, including the earliest forms of runes called Elder Futhark, or Futhark, and 2 types of cipher. It's not clear in what order the sections of the text are supposed to be read, or if it was even intended to be understood by mortals at all. I don't think this was ever meant to be read by humans, says Bo Graslund, an archaeologist at Uppsala University. It was only meant for the gods. Now a team composed of Williams, Graslund, University of Gothenburg linguist Per Holmberg, and Stockholm University historian of religion Olaf Sundquist has developed a new interpretation of the inscription that ties it to themes in Norse mythology and to a devastating 6th century climate crisis. The very beginning of the inscription, scholars generally agree it is the beginning, describes Vemoth as death-doomed. While most runestones memorialize the dead, says Williams, this phrase is unique to the rock and suggests that the young man was fated to die for a particular reason. Based on a number of allusions strewn throughout the inscription, the researchers believe that Vemoth perished so he could join the army of the chief Norse god Odin in Ragnarok, the apocalyptic battle pitting the Vikings against their enemies, the giants. In one section, the researchers have detected a reference to one of the chief giants, the monstrous wolf Fenrir, swallowing the sun, the act that sets Ragnarok in motion. Another section describes Fenrir facing off against 20 kings, members of Odin's army, on the Grove of Sparks, a name for the Ragnarok battlefield. And near the end of the inscription, the team has gleaned a reference to Odin's son, Vitar, who vanquishes Fenrir after the creature kills his father. Only then can the son's daughter take her mother's place in the sky. For the team, another key to the inscription's meaning is found in a line that mentions someone who 9 generations ago lost their life. Given that the runestone dates to around AD 800 and allowing 30 years per generation, This event would have occurred in the early 16th century. The scholars believe the line describes the death of the sun and refers to a period beginning in AD 536, when a series of volcanic eruptions is known to have blocked sunlight for several years, leading to mass starvation. This reference to events of nearly three centuries earlier, the researchers suggest, was likely prompted by a number of happenings reminiscent of those harrowing times. We know that there were solar storms that turned the sky red and would have caused very cold summers, Williams says. And there was a near total solar eclipse that would have scared the hell out of people. With the threat of a crisis looming, Weymouth is described on the runestone as having been cut down before his time in order to help Odin's army defeat the giants, ensuring that the sun would continue to shine. Our next article is titled Off the Grid, Castlereagh, England, and this is written by Marley Brown. When some of the first British farmers to live in the Lake District needed to gather at a central location, they may have chosen Castlereagh Stone Circle, a Neolithic monument built some 5,000 years ago. The circle measures almost 100 feet in diameter and consists of 38 stones varying in height from 3.5 to 7.5 feet. Later Bronze Age stone monuments often contain burials, but no human remains have been discovered at Castlereagh. Rather than serving as a memorial to the dead, the circle likely hosted a mix of community functions. A helpful analogy is the medieval parish church, which was a religious center, but also often the site of social gathering and the marketplace, says archaeologist Tom Clare, emeritus of Liverpool John Morris University. At the time Castlereagh was built, much of northern Europe was heavily forested, and the Lake District's valley bottoms were often filled with standing water or dense swampland. Castlereagh's position on a low ridgeline at the center of three valleys would have placed it along a traversable pathway for farmers moving livestock from higher pastures in the summer months down to lower elevation for the winter, explains ecologist David Wilkinson of the University of Lincoln. Some of the stones at Castlereagh that were lying on their side when antiquarians such as William Stuckley observed the site in the ancient 18th century have since been put upright. Clare cautions that making exact determinations about the cosmological or spiritual meaning of the monument to those who built it may never be possible. Still, the task of raising the stones of Castlereagh would have required a level of effort in proportion to its profound importance to the community. One generation might have added to what the previous generation did, Clare says. Part of the process of being involved in this society was that you contributed labor, you helped contribute to these communal structures. The site. The stone circle is most easily accessible by car, and the route is well marked from the neighboring town of Keswick. Visitors can park along the road approaching the circle. Be prepared to walk uphill. On reaching the field, look for a wide gap in the circle flanked by two tall stones. This may have been the entrance to the monument and is a feature also found in earlier Neolithic timber structures. This similarity has led some researchers to suggest Castlereagh may be a particularly early example of a Neolithic stone circle. While you're there, the Lake District may be as well known for its literary heritage as it is for its physical majesty. and many of the so-called Lake poets were inspired by Castlereagh. After leaving the site, take a 15-minute drive south to the village of Grasmere to visit the Wordsworth Trust. Then continue south another 11 miles to tour Beatrix Potter's Hilltop Farmhouse. Our next article is titled Ice Age Icebox, written by Marley Brown. When a circular structure measuring more than 40 feet in diameter, made entirely from mammoth bones, was discovered in western Russia in 2014, its purpose was unclear. Now researchers have investigated debris from the site of Kostenki, which is located along the Don River just south of the Russian city of Voronezh, and was inhabited by hunter-gatherers some 25,000 years ago. By separating possible evidence of human habitation, such as charcoal produced by fires from sediment, they determined that the structure was likely not used for shelter. The density of this debris was far less than we'd expect to see if it was an intensively occupied dwelling, says archaeologist Alexander Pryor of the University of Exeter. It would have been difficult to build a roof on such a large structure, he adds. Furthermore, many of the bones used to build it appear to have had fat and cartilage still attached to them, which would have created a smelly, unhygienic environment. Instead, Pryor suggests the structure may have been used to store food, possibly allowing the community to eat well while remaining at the site for weeks or even months at a time. Our next article is titled Sticking Its Neck Out. Skulls receive most of the attention in the study of human evolution. But the atlas vertebrae, which sits just beneath the cranium, at the top of the spinal column, can also provide valuable information about humanity's early ancestors. Atlas vertebrae rarely survive in the fossil record, but the skeleton of Littlefoot, a 3.67 million-year-old human ancestor belonging to the species Australopithecus Prometheus, which was discovered at the site of Sterkfontein in South Africa, includes a particularly well-preserved example. An international research team recently made a micro CT scan of Littlefoot's atlas vertebrae. It revealed that the Australopithecine had already evolved a human-like head posture, even though it had an ape-sized brain measuring just one-third the size of a modern human brain. The scan also showed that compared with modern humans, blood flowed through the atlas vertebrae to Littlefoot's brain at a much lower rate. According to Amelie Baudet of the University of the Witwatersrand, this indicates that Australopithecines probably did not eat the calorie and protein-rich diet that allowed larger brains to evolve. The next article is titled History in Ice, written by Jason Urbanus. Lead pollution levels from the Middle Ages preserved in an ice core taken from Colle Nifedi Glacier in the Swiss Alps reflect political upheaval in England. Some 500 miles away, a multidisciplinary research team has found. In addition to studying archaeological data and tax records, the researchers used lasers to measure how lead levels in the core changed from year to year. They observed a major spike in lead pollution during the reign of the English Angevin kings, Henry II, Richard I, and John. Between 1154 and 1216, when economic growth led to an increase in silver and lead production from British mines. Lead particles from the extraction and smelting processes were carried southeast by weather patterns, and traces of the metal were trapped in Swiss glaciers. The researchers noticed fluctuations in annual pollution levels, which they were able to correlate with specific historical events. During wartime, or when a monarch died, lead production dipped, leading to lower levels. When a new monarch was secure, there were usually major building projects that required an increase in revenue in raw materials, which, in turn, produced more pollution. Specific occurrences that appear to match changes in lead pollution levels include the death of Henry II in 1189, Richard I's absence during the Third Crusade from 1190 to 1194, and the assassination of Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury in 1170. The whole team was very surprised at the extent of demonstrable association between political events, lead production, and lead and silver pollution in the glacier, says University of Nottingham archaeologist Christopher Lovelock. It was one of those X marks the spot moments that never happen. Our next article is titled Roman River Cruiser, written by Benjamin Leonard. Strip miners in the eastern Serbian town of Drmno uncovered a flat-bottom ship and two monoziles, or dugout longboats, along the banks of an ancient tributary of the Danube near the garrison at the Roman city of Viminacium. Measuring nearly 50 feet long and built for navigating shallow waters, the ship, which carried a crew of between 30 and 40, was used for either transport or combat. The timber-carved longboats were of a type used by the Avars and other nomadic groups who attacked the Romans at Viminacium. All three levels likely date to the Roman period, explains archaeologist Miromir Korak of the Institute of Archaeology in Belgrade. There is a possibility that the monoziles were part of the invasion fleet that ultimately ended life as the Romans knew it at Viminacium in the early 7th century AD, he says. It looks like they were simply abandoned on the banks. Our next article is titled IDing England's First Nun, written by Eric A. Powell. Many people in the port town of Folkestone in southeastern England still revere St. Ainswith, a 7th century Anglo-Saxon princess who helped found Folkestone Priory, the first nunnery in England. Her remains were thought to have been interred at the priory until the 1530s, but went missing after Henry VIII dissolved the country's monasteries. In 1885, a lead container with human bones was discovered concealed in a wall near the priory's altar. It was long assumed the relics were St. Ainsworth's and that they had been hidden to protect them from the Tudor king's machinations. Now, work on the reliquary, led by Canterbury Archaeologists Trust archaeologist Andrew Richardson, has provided new evidence that the remains are in fact those of the missing woman. The team's study shows that the container dates to around the 8th century, in that the remains belong to a young woman of about 20 years old who lived in the mid-7th century. Says Richardson, the strong probability is that this young person concealed in a prestigious location within a church known to have housed her remains, is indeed Ainsworth. Our next article is titled Play Ball by Jason Urbanus. The discovery of a 3,400-year-old ball court in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca has led archaeologists to reconsider the origins of a popular ancient Mesoamerican sport. Although several different types of ball games were played by the Olmecs, the Maya, and the Aztecs, the best-known version was contested on a monumental stone court and involved players knocking around a rubber ball using their hips. The earliest evidence for these ball courts dates to around 1650 BC, and their prevalence at sites near the Gulf Coast and in the Pacific coastal lowlands has led scholars to believe that the game was developed in that region. However, recent excavations at the highland site of Etlatango have uncovered two of these structures, as well as ball player figurines, suggesting that highland societies were playing the ball game almost as early as their lowland counterparts. One of the courts dates to between 1443 and 1305 BC, making it 800 years older than any other playing field previously found in a highland context. The discovery of these ball courts in Oaxaca indicates that highland groups were important players in the development of the formal ball game, says George Washington University archaeologist Jeffrey Blomster. The hip ball game's development was an important part of the establishment of Mesoamerican civilizations, and multiple regions were involved in its origins. Our last article is titled Prized Polo Donkeys. This is written by Benjamin Leonard. Remains of three small donkeys unearthed in a noblewoman's tomb in the ancient Chinese capital of Chenang might provide the first archaeological evidence of the game Livju, or donkey polo. According to Tang Dynasty historical texts, the sport was a favorite pastime of elite women and older members of the imperial court, providing a safer alternative to the dangerous, often fatal version played on horseback. The sacrifice of these donkeys seems to have been a rare event carried out in honor of the deceased, a woman named Cui Shi, who died in AD 878. At the age of 59. Her husband, Bao Gao, was a provincial governor whose horse polo playing prowess earned him a promotion and cost him an eye. Biomechanical analysis of the donkey bones by a Chinese-American research team has shown that the animals experienced unusual patterns of locomotion, such as rapid acceleration and deceleration, that could be consistent with playing polo, explains anthropologist Fiona Marshall of Washington University in St. Louis. Whether or not these were Cu Shi's actual polo donkeys, they may have been buried with her along with a lead stirrup to enable her to continue to play the game in the afterlife. You have been listening to Archaeology on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Patty Martin saying goodbye from Owl Radio.